Good afternoon. This is Valley Voices. I'm your host, Amy Haddon Marsh. My guest today is author, activist, and feminist Starhawk. She has written many nonfiction books about her experiences, the reclaiming movement, and permaculture, among other things. She's also written a fiction series, which includes The Fifth Sacred Thing, published in 1993. Just this month, that book was published as an audiobook, and to celebrate a resurgence of interest in the vision of The Fifth Sacred Thing, I spoke with Starhawk by phone from her home near San Francisco. The book was published in 1993 and is set in 2048 California. Can you talk about your vision of the city of 2048 and how you came to this?
Yeah, when I was writing The Fifth Sacred Thing, I was very interested in how do we create a positive vision of the future. And for me, it was important to create it around the cities, not just around how do we go back to the land, although I love doing that, but most people live in cities. So what are we going to do with our cities? Is it possible you could have an ecologically balanced, beautiful, socially just, wonderful city? And wouldn't that be nice if you could?
Yeah.
So I had a lot of fun mentally transforming San Francisco, where I've lived for many, many years, into that vision. And what's interesting is to see pieces of it happening and coming alive in San Francisco and in other cities today. You know, that was almost 25 years ago. We didn't have nearly the movement for things like urban gardening, community gardens in San Francisco. In the book, people actually tore up the city streets to plant gardens and grow food.
Right.
And actually in San Francisco today, it's not that they've torn up the streets, but there are streets where they have put little bump outs with little mini parks on, and they've done curb cuts so that the runoff water from storms goes into rain gardens instead of into the sewers. And there are just many little aspects of things in the book that seem to be coming true.
Well, I noticed that myself. I spent the whole weekend rereading this.
Uh-huh.
And in the early part of the book, I thought, well, a lot of this is happening now. I agree with you in that vision mm-hmm. is coming true a little bit.
Yes, both the good and the bad, because in the book, the Southlands have, Southern California, have gone in the other direction and become much more brutal and militarist. And, of course, unfortunately, we see those things also happening at the same time.
You know, the book, as you say, was published almost 25 years ago. What were you doing at that time, and what inspired this incredibly rich and complicated story?
I had been doing many years of work writing and teaching about earth-based spirituality and feminist spirituality, and I had also been doing many years of activism around nuclear issues and military intervention and training people in nonviolence. So for me, a big part of the book really centered around that question of how do you respond to violence from some other dimension? How do you protect yourself against brutal militarism and cruelty and destruction without becoming what you're fighting against?
There is a character, one of my favorites is Lily.
Yes.
Who says to Maya, who is someone of her age, they're both elders for people who haven't read it, and I'm wondering if I can read this little piece, or do you have the book in front of you?
No, I don't.
You don't?
So please, go ahead.
Magic is the art of changing consciousness at will. You can look at a war as a massing of arms and materiel and troops, but you can also see it as something else, a delicate web of interwoven choices made by human beings, made out of a certain consciousness. The decision to order an attack, the choice to obey or disobey an order, to fire or not to fire a weapon. Armies, and indeed any culture that supports them, must convince the people that all decisions are made already and they have no choice. But that's never true. So mad as it may seem, this is the terrain upon which we base our defense of this city, the landscape of consciousness. And to me, that sums up the point of the fifth sacred thing.
Yes. In the book, Lily is very much the voice for that understanding. And it really came out for me again of many years of training people and practicing how do we actually contest what seems like overwhelming power, again, from a different perspective. And understanding it's not the gun that we're really fighting against. It's the mind that chooses to fire the gun. And if we can reach that mind to make a different choice, then the gun is no longer a weapon.
So what is it about your nonviolent training that convinced you that this could be effective?
Well, I would say, you know, in the sense the novel for me isn't so much about conviction. It was about wrestling with the question because I don't think we have, I mean, I couldn't stand up here and say complete, perfect nonviolence is always going to be effective. Clearly, it's not. But I believe it's always worth wrestling with that question and wrestling with the question of what does violence actually do to us? In the sequel, in City of Refuge, which came out last year to The Fifth Sacred Thing, I feel like I'm tackling the question from a somewhat different perspective. It's not so much the voice of perfect nonviolence, but it's each character wrestling with their own internal changes around the question of how we actually liberate people who are so damaged by this old system and all the different ways that that damage operates.
How can these people build a new world when people are so deeply wounded by the old?
Yeah.
Where does that question come from in you?
Well, for me, I guess from lots of personal experience, but also really most immediately, it came out of the Occupy movement, which had its, you know, big flourish right when I was starting to write that book. And I could just see people struggling with organizing and having this incredible vision and yet running up against deep wounds and the deep question of how do we actually just get along with one another. The book I wrote that right before is called The Empowerment Manual, A Guide for Collaborative Groups. And it's actually a very different book. It's a nonfiction book about group dynamics and organizing and communication. That came out of 40 years of working in collaborative groups of different kinds, from spiritual groups to political groups to permaculture groups, and seeing them all struggle with these same questions. You know, how do we actually get along with each other? How do we resolve our differences? How do we move through conflict in a way that furthers what we're trying to do and doesn't just destroy the group and the people in it?
Right. That's something that I've noticed. I've been on the board of directors of a few groups, and one of which was a group out in Nevada that worked on some of the test site gatherings, which is where I first met you.
Uh-huh.
When the group pulled together, it also blew itself apart. You know, there was a lot of infighting. And I've seen that happen in a lot of groups that are working on organizing and working for the greater good or a better society or a better something. I guess I'm wondering if that's the same thing you're talking about.
Yes. You know, that happens over and over and over again. And I started looking at it and going, why are all these different groups struggling with the same issue? And I think the thing is that if you have a group with top-down authority, we're all kind of familiar with that pattern. You know, we grew up in a family and, you know, there's a mom or a dad maybe who can come in and just say, hey, you two, stop fighting. You know, leave your brother alone. And we get into a group that we define as being horizontal, as non-hierarchical. And there's no mom or dad to come in and say, hey, you two, stop fighting. So we need to develop other, I think, more sophisticated methods of dealing with conflict, because there's no one in the group who has the authority to end it. And without that, unless we have agreements about how to resolve a conflict, unless we have a real commitment to dealing with it with integrity and have some tools and skills for that, a conflict can just bounce around and around and around a group, and there's almost no way to get rid of it.
I think you wrote about all of this stuff so incredibly well.
Oh, thank you.
You know, it's so complicated, and as I mentioned before, it's so rich. Talk about what it was like for you to write all of this stuff. I mean, you know, you're really articulate about it, but you had to put it in other characters, and you had to sort of have them act it out. How did you do that?
Well, writing fiction, I find, is a very interesting process because it's kind of like going into a trance for months at a time. You envision your characters, and then you kind of sit back and listen to them. And they do really take on a life and a reality of their own. So sometimes they will do things, you know, that you kind of have arguments with. You know?
You're arguing with your characters, are you still?
You know, with Madrone in The Fifth Sacred Thing, there are moments like, don't sleep with that guy. That's going to be a bad idea. No.
I'd like to remind listeners that my guest today is Starhawk. She's a leader in the reclaiming tradition. She's an author. She's an activist and a permaculture expert. And she's joining me by phone from Northern California. Starhawk, you are a leader, as I mentioned, in earth-based spirituality, sort of the revival of goddess religion. And you co-founded something called Reclaiming.
Mm-hmm.
Which, according to your website, is an activist branch of modern pagan religion. Talk about Reclaiming and how it influenced The Fifth Sacred Thing.
Yes, Reclaiming really came out of a bunch of us in the Bay Area in the late 70s and early 80s who had always been activists, but who were really searching for some kind of sense of spirituality and community that that fit with our belief that we need to be engaged with the world, that we didn't want to just withdraw and meditate. We wanted to actually have an impact on the world and around bringing forth a world of greater justice around us. And many of us had been looking at the old goddess religions of Europe and the Middle East that came out of our feminism, you know, our search for, have there ever been, are there spiritual traditions, religious traditions with female images of empowerment that actually empower women and give women roles of leadership and responsibility? And we began finding some of the roots of the goddess traditions. The work of the archaeologist Maria Gimbutas was very important to us. And studying with people who are practicing Wicca, which is sometimes called witchcraft, which is really the inheritor of those old pagan traditions, and kind of identifying with that, saying, yes, let's reclaim this word that means really a powerful woman, a shaper, a weaver, someone who can bend or twist your fate, a healer, an herbalist. Let's not let this word become something where we always see women of power as negative and dangerous. Let us reclaim it and own it and find some of the roots that can help us learn how to more deeply connect with the land around us and the earth around us. And I think, you know, many people now are, you know, have been searching for things like shamanism, have been attracted to other kinds of indigenous religions. And there's always the debate that comes up around cultural appropriation and,
exactly.
You know, whose tradition do you have the right to explore? And for us, it was important, since many of us were people who have European heritage, to explore some of the roots of our own traditions and understand that all of us come from people who at some point were indigenous somewhere. If we can recover that connection, then I think we can find ways to support the struggles of indigenous people today who are so much on the front lines of all the environmental struggles and all the struggles to protect land and water. We can maybe do that from a more authentic and empowered place.
Exactly.
So reclaiming began with like five of us in my living room, and we began teaching, and we had gone through a lot of struggles around how to share power in our group, teaching in pairs and teaching in groups to model that shared power. And now today it's really a network with groups in U.S. and Canada and Europe and Australia and many places around the world.
That's fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah,
I know
people want to learn more or find a group close to you. You can look at reclaiming.org or witchcamp.org. And, you know, there are many groups that are doing public rituals and offering courses and teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just at the point of starting to get more also available online.
Great. You've developed so much, and there aren't any texts associated with goddess worship in the old Celtic religions. You know, if there had been, they've long been destroyed. So how did you come up with all of these?
Well, there are pieces of the tradition that survived in families and that have been passed down in various ways. There's also a lot you can learn from, you know, I think a lot of the texts got buried and transformed into folk tales and fairy tales, which we work with a lot in reclaiming. You know, oftentimes we'll have a witch camp, we'll have a week-long retreat, and we'll take a story and go into it in ritual over the course of five or six nights and explore some of its inner meanings and depths. You can look at the artwork, you can look at the symbols, and there are places, you know, I just was in Spain and we were teaching a permaculture course in the Basque country, and you know, in that area, the old pagan traditions are still very much remembered and very much alive. We were teaching at the foot of this beautiful mountain that was called Amari, that was sacred to the great goddess Mari. And we went to a place called Zigaramurdi, where they have ancient caves that were the place of gatherings for thousands of years. And still, the local people have gatherings and festivals there. It was also a place where there were very intense witch persecutions back in the 16th century. And the witch museum was very interesting because the bottom floor was all about the persecutions and the trials. And the top floor was all about the goddess and the various gods and the pagan traditions. And the whole religion is very much remembered there and very much alive.
So there's a witch museum in the Basque country?
Yes.
That's
it was
amazing.
An amazing experience to go there. You know, it's almost hard to describe, but it's like, here's this history we've been talking about. I've been writing about it for 30 or 40 years. We've been arguing about it. There have been controversies around it. And here you go to a town and a place where it is the history. It's the museum. It's right there.
It must have felt like coming home.
Yes, it did, very much. And, of course, the Basque language is the oldest in Europe. They call it original Cro-Magnon. You
know, wow.
It's a place where there's very much an independent spirit among the people.
You've been working with permaculture, and I'm wondering how that ties in with reclaiming and the work that you've done previously.
Well, for me, reclaiming has always been the spiritual aspect of connecting to the earth. And permaculture, you could say, is the how-to part. It's really applying systems thinking, not just to land, but to actually finding ways we meet our human needs in ways that actually regenerate the environment around us. And to me, that's tremendously exciting, especially right now in these times when we have such grave environmental crises. I teach permaculture design, but we always teach it in a form that includes connection to spirit and focus on organizing and activism. Because it's not just how you grow a garden, it's how you change the policy in your town to allow you to use some of the gray water from your sink to help grow your fruit trees in your garden. It's about how we shift our energy sources, our economy, our food growing systems, again, to bring them back in harmony with nature. And in doing that, you know, we have the capacity to regenerate landscape and environment on a large scale. We actually know how to do that. It's not actually that difficult to do, and it can actually be done amazingly quickly. We desperately need to do that on a massive scale right now because climate change is environmental degradation on a massive scale. So to me, that's very sacred work as well. It is the enacted work of the spirit.
That's wonderful. You know, you should come out here, Starhawk. There's the Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute with Jerome Osentowski. Have you been out here to see it?
No, but I have met him at conferences and seen his slideshow on his work, which is so inspiring. Our organization is called Earth Activist Training. If people are interested, we have upcoming courses in permaculture design and something we're calling social permaculture, which is really looking at some of those issues around how we get together, what are some of the underlying patterns of how we organize as human beings, and how can we design our organizations to create beneficial relationships between the people in them.
Can you give an example of social permaculture?
For example, one of the permaculture principles is diversity creates resilience. And if we look at that in a social sense, if we have a group, people who are all from the same age and gender and philosophy and class background and race and life experience, we have a much less resilient understanding of the world than if we have more human diversity. So how do we actually design for that diversity? Well, we have to look very carefully at the patterns that separate us. We might have to look at things like racism and the ways that we internalize it and respond to it and say, well, how can we change that pattern to undo that? In Earth Activist Training, for example, we've given diversity scholarships to people of color, so that we're not just bringing in one person of color, but trying to bring in enough diversity that it actually changes the culture of the group. And that has been really a very powerful tool for change. And then how do we mentor people so that they can move into roles of leadership and not just, you know, be window dressing, and that bring that different perspective to actually reshape our thinking and help us look at the world in a more full and round sense.
You know, you bring in enough diversity to change the culture of the group.
Mm.
And what's it been like to experience that?
I think it's challenging for all of us because we all tend to think our view of the world is the view of the world. And when you encounter a view that's different or you encounter life experience that's different, sometimes it's an inner jolt. It's like, oh my goodness, like maybe a lot of my assumptions are wrong and I have to question that. And it can be very unsettling for people. So it can take some skill to facilitate, to really say, how do we create an environment that's welcoming to everyone, where everyone can show up in the fullness and the complexity of who we are and feel seen and feel welcomed, and where sometimes we have different perspectives, where we can embrace that and say, okay, that little jolt, that little moment of discomfort is actually a moment of growth. We don't grow if we stay perfectly comfortable. We have to be like challenged sometimes, pushed to some of our edges. And if we can embrace that, then the feeling and the spirit and just the joy that comes up in the group is almost very, very hard to describe, but it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
Well, Starhawk, thanks very much. And I look forward to seeing you out here at Jerome's Colorado Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute someday soon.
That would be lovely.
You've been listening to Valley Voices. My guest has been author and activist Starhawk. We will link to her websites at kdnk.org.